Hello and welcome to Marketing Room 101. I'm Ben Norman, Strategy Director at Principles, a brand comms agency in Leeds. And this is a podcast where I invite marketers to join me for a good old rant and give them the chance to banish one thing from the industry forever. In this episode, I speak to Joe Wallace, Global Executive Creative Director at Jellyfish and founder of Good Girls Eat Dinner and host of the Good Girls Eat Dinner podcast. Joe has held senior positions in some of the most famous creative businesses in London, like Saatchi & Saatchi and Wunderman Thompson. But in 2022, she moved out to LA as Global ECD at Media Monks before joining Jellyfish. We got to talk about the differences between the UK and LA, the challenges facing women in senior leadership, how to get closer to true diversity at the top, plus the need for brands and agencies to be committed to single-minded briefs and ideas, and much, much more. So here's my conversation in Marketing Room 101 with Joe Wallace. Joe, welcome to Marketing Room 101.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
My pleasure entirely. So, Joe, just to get us started, for our listeners' sake, could you please tell me what it's like in here in Marketing Room 101?
Well, it's not really a place I want to be honest. And I'm someone who is really affected by my surroundings visually. I like to be in a space that is nicely designed and thoughtful interior design with impeccable finishes. And this is definitely not that. It kind of feels like somewhere that maybe in its heyday, it was kind of lovely, but now it's really tired. And you can tell that rather than them redesigning it properly, they've just sort of like bolted bits on as the eras went by. And now there's this kind of motley collection of furniture, everything from the 50s to the 80s to the noughties and to now. And where the paint has flaked or someone's made a dent in the wall, it's just been painted over. And I'm fairly sure there's a load of like fag ends swept under the carpet. Nothing works properly. There seems to be a fax machine endlessly printing something out, which I suspect might be client amends. But yeah, it's pretty bleak in here.
I think for our listeners, Joe, I'd actually asked you to be hypothetical with this, but I think you might have just described my office.
No, I'm just kidding. Hear that.
No, I'm just kidding. It sounds like one of those places where if you took certain aspects of it individually, they might be okay. That might be that there is a bit of like a cool 1980s sort of vibe in a certain place. But when you cross that over with some form of noughties chic with a little bit of 1950s cabinet, it's quite a hellish look, right?
Yeah. And the kind of nothing matching and it all just feeling a bit to the senses.
In terms of your actual working environment, how does London compare to LA in terms of your productivity and how you work?
I mean, I think it's quite interesting in the sense that London and my productivity in the way that I worked pre-COVID was obviously the very typical, always in the office, working late, constantly kind of on it with briefs and teams and directing teams and then being on shoots and making work happen. And then obviously COVID struck and we were in that kind of lockdown phase where it meant that working in London even was different. And I think it really kind of showcased that, yes, we can do things remotely that perhaps we never thought we could before, even a shoot, for example. And then we never really got back into proper work of a way that it was recognizable pre-COVID before I then moved to LA. So it's quite difficult to compare because since being in LA, it's always been the new age kind of way of working, I guess, which is that hybrid way of working. So I think what is lovely is that it isn't always raining and it isn't always cold. And so there's a kind of really positive feeling to work, whether I'm working from home or whether I'm in the office. It just does feel different. I mean, commuting is obviously very different. I do not miss getting on the tube. For example, people talk about LA and it being like really full of traffic, but I've never experienced it being that bad. So I'm always quite content to commute in my car with my own podcast, not my own podcast, but with my podcast choice playing and, you know, kind of being able to drive right up to the office, park, get out, go to work and then easily get home. Not kind of the mercy of any tube strike or being crushed into the public transport.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It'd be interesting you mentioned the weather. I know the weather is it's a real British cliche to talk about, but today is the day in the UK where the sun has come out for the first time. And where I am up in Leeds, the pubs have been filled with people outside. You get that real buzz. I love the novelty of that when it does change, but you forget what it's actually like for the sun to be out and how much that changes how you feel. It's quite an exciting time, but imagining what it might be like in LA.
Yeah, definitely like shifts mentality. I think that the sunshine absolutely plays a part on how you're feeling and how you then relate to other people, to your work, to life in general. So, yeah.
So, Jo, you are Global Executive Creative Director at Jellyfish in LA by day. And by night, you are founder of Good Girls Eat Dinner, which maybe makes you sound like some weird kind of superhero. But I wondered if you could tell me and tell our listeners, what is Jellyfish and why do good girls eat dinner?
Yeah, so Jellyfish is a marketing company for the digital world, and we combine data, media, tech and creativity. And we're very much about the fact that we know that success demands a creative multi-platform mindset. And our founding ownership kind of company run by David Jones is the Brand Tech Group, which is the number one digital agency, marketing agency in the world, and very, very much looking to push the brilliance and the possibilities of AI. So in terms of my role, we have, if we're looking at the capability that is creative and experience, we've actually, since I joined, split that into two parts. So we have AI studios and we have Creative Collective, which I very much oversee. Within the whole of creative and experience, we have about 350 people globally. And Creative Collective is very much human ingenuity, that human imagination and brilliance being very much supported and utilizing AI as is necessary and as it makes sense. And then AI Studios is incredibly AI focused. We have a proprietary tool called Pencil, for example. We're able to deliver assets at scale and really shift up those assets and adjust them in real time, depending how they're performing. So we have a brilliant offering over the whole breadth of everything. And then obviously outside of my particular remit, we have media. We even do aspects of training. So yeah, it's a multifaceted, really interesting, lively, different aspects coming together. And it feels very different to your traditional holdcos, for example.
So you spent a lot of your career working in really well-established London agencies. How has the shift felt for you going from those established London agencies into such an innovative, future-facing, AI-embracing LA agency? What have been the biggest sort of shifts for you with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the first stepping stone was when I joined Media Monks. So I went from what was then Wunderman Thompson to Media Monks. That was a US-focused role. That was why I first moved to LA. And that was, I guess, the first step into that world. But I could already see that the traditional agencies were no longer really where it was at. And I love a different challenge and trying to stay on that forefront of what's next. And having done 20 years in more traditional agencies, I felt that it was no bad thing to try something else. So first of all, going to Media Monks, which was obviously a very different format and setup. And then from there, the steps to Jellyfish made a lot of sense as well, because that was just an even more kind of future facing, different space. And I'm well aware that there would have been people that raised an eyebrow at the fact that I was going to Jellyfish. But I think that there's so much potential there. Our client list is just incredible. We work with the biggest platforms. We actually help them do their social, for example. We work with brands such as Netflix and ones I can't mention, and Toyota, and so many amazing brands, Amazon, Google. So I think that there's just so much potential there to do something new and innovative. And what I really relish is the fact that we have around 30 to 40 offices across the globe. I happen to be in LA, but I'm often in London or New York as well. And even, you know, Paris, Madrid, there's these different offices and different ecosystems that we're all very much interconnected. So the VPs of creative that work in TME, there are currently five of them, and they're all across the globe. And we're really, really talking to one another all the time. We're sharing resource as and when it makes sense in a really fluid way that I never actually experienced in a holdco, because there would always be a different P&L. There would always be a little bit of infighting about whose job this was or who was going to be getting the money for that. Whereas we do have the ability to kind of share that resource.
It's really interesting when you talk about the shift towards being really future facing. And in the last episode, I spoke to Kev Chesters, who talks a lot about the definition of creativity. And his point is, if you read the dictionary, the definition of creativity is the pursuit of the new. And I think if you're not, as a business, constantly in pursuit of the new and in pursuit of new ideas, even if that makes you feel uncomfortable, then you're not being creative. If you've stagnated, then you're doing the very opposite of the dictionary definition of creativity. And I think that's something that I found really interesting in what you've just said there. Now, in terms of what you do outside of the day job, tell me, why do Good Girls Eat Dinner?
Well, Good Girls Eat Dinner, it's actually interesting. The name is obviously quite tongue-in-cheek, but also it came from the fact that years and years ago, when I was a CD at Saatchi & Saatchi, I was asked to give a talk about being a female creative director. And I think at the time, the stats were something like only 9 to 12% of creative directors were women. So when I was asked to give this talk, I thought to myself, well, I'm going to be preaching to the converted here. The people that are going to come to that talk are most likely to be women who will know that they're more than capable of being creative. And so I thought, okay, how can I reach a wider audience and actually make more of an impact? So myself and a team at Saatchi & Saatchi at the time, we basically co-created and co-curated an exhibition where we showcased 20 amazing female artists, directors, sculptors. We had various artists from Alison Jackson to Sarah Pope to Pam Glue. And we had the private view in the foyer of the then iconic Charlotte Street offices of Saatchi & Saatchi. And we got tons of press around it, not just in the industry press, but in external, you know, the real world press, the Independent, BBC Radio, etc. And I really saw the hunger, excuse the pun, for seeing more female role models across the creative industries. And I'd had this idea in my mind about doing an event where it was like a dining event, it wasn't corporate in any way, and I would have speakers speak briefly between the courses of a meal and really just have that inspiration and those visible role models. And the exhibition that we did was actually called There's a Good Girl. And we'd named it after a book by Marianne Graubrücker, who was writing about trying to bring her daughter up in a gender neutral way. So we asked her and her publisher if we could use that name for the exhibition, and they agreed. And so that was called There's a Good Girl. So Good Girls Eat Dinner kind of then fell out of that in a slightly natural way. And yes, so basically, I started in 2015. The mission was really simple: to serve up more visible female role models from across the creative industries and to do it in a way that doesn't feel any way like a conference. And when I was living in London, I would do one every 2 months, and it would be in various restaurants across London, from the Top of the Gherkin at the Circe's restaurant to Concrete beneath Shoreditch House. And each time I would invite four diverse, inspirational women to share their experiences and advice between the courses of the meal. And honestly, the energy in the room each time was always so incredible. I had people message me afterwards saying things like, I've now started my own business. Like, I've had speakers such as Trini Woodall, for example, who's now an amazing entrepreneur with her Trini London beauty range. And even the first Black stunt woman in Hollywood was a speaker. Kathy Newman from Channel 4 News has been a speaker. But also people that are maybe less in the public eye, but are still so inspirational. And I actually just did one when I was in London recently at the Shard, which is the London HQ of Jellyfish. And it coincided with it being 10 years since I started Good Girls Eat Dinner. So we had a really successful event with hundreds of people and four speakers where we were talking about Gen AI and the exponential power in relation to creativity. So yeah, it's been a really interesting side project that I absolutely love. And when I moved to LA, I then realized I couldn't really do real life events in London anymore. And I wasn't at the point of doing them just yet in LA. So I started a podcast. And as we were just talking about before we began recording, I thought it would be less work, but it's more work. There we go.
Yeah. I think I'm in the exact same boat there. It's a labor of love, but it's certainly a labor.
Absolutely. So that's the takeaway form of Good Girls Eat Dinner.
I think it's quite incredible when you say there about 10 years and you mention some of the names you've just mentioned there, and you think you've been going now long enough and doing that long enough to see the real impact of it. You know, you do something for 12 months, you do something for 2 years, you might be able to start getting an idea of where it could go, but it must feel incredible looking back on that 10 years and thinking, actually, I remember that person coming to that event. That must be quite profound.
Yeah, and it's totally a one-woman band thing. So I did everything from the design, the emails, the liaising with the restaurants, the table plan. So I'd literally kind of have people's names in my head because I knew that where I'd put them on the table plan and things. And I'd be like, that person's come before. That's great to see that they're coming back. But yeah, like I say, the feedback's always been amazing. And I had the kind of slight tagline, it's the best dinner party you'll ever go to. And feedback has suggested that people really, really do enjoy it. So it's great.
That's brilliant. Now, we were going to get onto in a second what you want to banish from the industry. But before we do, you touched earlier on this idea that, you know, women don't as often get to the top positions in the industry, or that men are potentially more likely to be in more senior positions in our industry. If we think about our industry specifically and your own experiences over the years, do you think that the problem is that women aren't being appointed into the top positions? Or do you think the problem is more that women aren't having the right opportunities to be in position, to be considered for appointment to the top positions?
Yeah, I think it's a kind of medley of various factors. There's obviously a real issue around when a woman has a child, and motherhood spells the end of many women's career, not by choice, but because they're then pushed out of the industry. I think that just recently, Pregnant Then Screwed have done a piece around shredding your CV, because I think the stat was off the scale. It was well over 70% of women have had their careers curtailed by becoming a mother. And even over COVID, I know that the stats reflected that it was women's careers that were massively impacted over men's, because they were trying to juggle so much more of the other household labor. And it was often their role or their career that kind of got squashed much more. So I think we have a situation where systemically, the industry, and not just advertising, but I guess the world in general, it's built for a male way through life. And that's why, as much as you see companies kind of forcing people back to the office, that's all well and good if you look at it from one perspective. But if you look at it from the perspective of mothers being able to still work their day around their other responsibilities, then the lack of flexible working has always been a slight problem. And this is a business where it requires long hours. And I think there's a perception that a mother simply can't manage that. And they're not even given the choice sometimes. They're just assumed that they won't be able to. And so I think often there isn't necessarily the pipeline of women, although I think there are more than we are kind of led to believe. And when you do get to a level of leadership, that systemic male bias often makes it quite difficult, because you're often the only woman in the room, and having your voice heard can be quite hard. So I think there's a lot of factors around it, but there are some amazingly talented women that have made it to the top. Shaka Sabani, for example, Laura Jordan Bamback, to mention just a couple, and there are many, many more. So I didn't ever really have female bosses ever. My CDs, my ECDs, my CCOs were always men. And I learned so many incredible things from them, such as, you know, working with Trevor Robinson, who's been a guest on your podcast. I wouldn't change that for anything. It was just incredible. But I do wonder sometimes how my career may have been if I had have had a female role model. I almost had to make choices of like, okay, I know early on, I almost was trying to maybe emulate how a man would lead. And I realized very quickly, hang on, that doesn't work. But that was all I knew. So then I had to sort of develop my own way of leadership and getting comfortable with that and seeing that that was so much more effective for me. So yeah, it's a strange kind of set of affairs, really.
That makes a lot of sense. And yeah, I agree with everything you've said. I think, interestingly, almost all of my managers have been women as I've been coming through my career. And I don't know if that's helped shape my perspective. And then maybe if I do the same thing and I reflect, how different would my career have been had I had male role models? I don't know, but I think, yeah, I suppose the nature and nurture aspect as you're coming through your career is quite important, isn't it? For who you are actually exposed to.
Yeah. I think my biggest bugbear around it all is the recent narrative that men are somehow being pushed down in order for women to be promoted and hired, and that they are just token hires. And the stats just do not support that. So men still represent overwhelming numbers within the boardroom. They still tend to be promoted at a much, much higher level. But there's this bizarre narrative that even before we've got anywhere near the parity, there's a narrative that men are now the ones being kind of shunned in some way. And it's not the case. It's kind of a fraction of what women and people of color and people from diverse backgrounds have had to deal with their entire career. But it's a narrative that's taken hold, and I find it a bit sickening, to be honest. And then if you do get hired, it's like, oh, it's just a token hire. Whereas actually that person to ever get to that position would have had to work three times as hard.
How frustrating if you've worked three times as hard to then have everything you've worked for distilled into, oh, well, of course, you've been hired for that position. You're a woman and we need to make the numbers up. It's like, I've grafted my whole life for this and now it's been belittled.
Yeah, I think it's a very, you know, I absolutely support men to be promoted as much as women to be promoted. I think it's about realizing that there are biases. And I mean, it's been proven time and time and time again. If you take the names off of a CV, it hugely impacts who they would hire. Whereas if the names are on the CV, it's the man that will get hired. It's just a very obvious thing to me that there is an issue that needs addressing. And yet, as we try to potentially address it, it causes a lot of anger amongst people.
Yeah, nobody likes it to be harder for them, do they, without them considering that they've had a tailwind for 1,000 years. So you are here today to banish something from the marketing world forever. Now, I wanted to know what you would like to banish, please.
Okay, well, this has been a little tricky because, as I was saying to you, I've listened to, I think, pretty much all of your excellent podcasts.
Thank you very much.
Many of your guests have committed things to the abyss that I would probably have chosen. So Trevor Robinson, who I adore and worked with for 6 years, he's already put fear into the abyss. Vicky Ross, a good friend of mine, has already covered the serious subject of sexual harassment and bad players. And I know that dullness has already gone in there too, and a lack of great creativity. So I had a bit of
the room is getting
around
full.
This. Yes. And I've come up with something, it's a little bit throwaway, but I think my thing that I would like to commit to Room 101 is word salads.
Okay, not the word salads, word salads.
Word salads. So what I mean by that is that where we once celebrated the power of a single compelling message, we now seem to be in a world of word salads, where communications are just cluttered with many, many words and messages that means that none of them actually land. And I think that this actually shows up in a few ways. So from, I guess, the initial phase, often briefs are quite bloated nowadays. So
yes,
I feel like briefs have become like this masterclass in hedging. So what should be a sharp arrow pointing to a clear target has become a bit of a shotgun blast of objectives. Make people aware of our product, but also highlight our sustainability credentials while emphasizing our heritage. And don't forget about our new app and all the benefits of the product. And I think that's not really strategy. It's a bit of a failure to make a decision.
Exactly that. They are the problem, or all the problems, without any decision made, I'm not saying all, I mean, we get some very good briefs, but a lot of the time, like you say, you will get a lot of problems and then a request for a magic wand that somehow solves all of that. There needs to be a choice made. It needs to be choiceful, right?
Yeah. Or at least choose what message you want to say in which channel. You shouldn't necessarily try to do it all in one place, but you could definitely cover all of that across a broad spread of your media and channels. I think another aspect of it is ideas by committee often leads to these word salads because everyone wants their little bit of something in there. And I think the expertise of copywriters and art directors who have spent years honing the craft of distillation and delivering these complex messages with genius, engaging simplicity, they're now almost pushed to the side and increasingly treated as just mere executors of a committee's whim. And when you've got, you know, marketing managers, legal departments, someone's uncle's dog, all adding in an essential point, what you end up with is just a Frankenstein's monster of messages. And I think what any creative in advertising knows is that the actual skill in communication, it isn't addition, it's subtraction. And it's the courage to say, okay, here's what we're not saying, because what we need is something that actually engages, actually emotively speaks to somebody versus some logical train of words that ends up meaning nothing. And I think in an era where we are in such a space of media fragmentation and shrinking attention spans, we're weirdly creating more complex communications than ever and just sort of forgetting that need for the single-minded message. And I remember when I was studying graphic design and advertising on my degree course, and my tutor said, think about it like tennis balls. If you throw one tennis ball at somebody, they're going to catch it. If you throw many tennis balls at somebody, they're not going to catch it.
Yes, 100%.
Kind of a good analogy that stood the test of time. So, yeah.
We've all heard it, but I think we've all heard it for a reason. It's music to my ears, what you're saying. And there's a statement I always use if I'm speaking to clients about briefs, and it is, when you add, you subtract. And you'd sort of touched on earlier about, you know, the process of adding is the process of subtracting. You dilute, you reduce the impact of your message every time you add something. And ultimately, our job, whether you're a strategist, whether you're creative, is to try and distill it into what's the one thing that is going to have the biggest impact on how somebody thinks, feels, or acts. And I know I'm talking about the very basics of brief writing here, but yeah, I think you're 100% right. And I don't blame clients for it. I don't blame creatives for it. I blame the way organizations are set up. Are people allowed to make decisions? Like you said, right, you go right back to the start. There's no way a creative can come up with a single-minded concept, but there's also no way a client can write a single-minded brief if that person is not empowered to make a decision, to not put in what the CEO's nephew's boyfriend who works in social media said.
And also, I mean, when we think about word salads, it's just, why waste money and time creating these bloated garbage salads of words that nobody's going to, like, they're not going to shift the dial. And the sad thing is that instead of people going, oh, I think we probably tried to say too much, they kind of come back and think, oh, we clearly didn't say enough. We need to make sure we say a bit more to make sure that people understand.
So I'm absolutely convinced that being here in Marketing Room 101 will make my life easier and more enjoyable. While you are here, would you like to return anything to the marketing world that you think is trapped in here in this space?
Yeah, I think recognizing the value of creativity and experts in creativity. So as I was saying, I think people that have spent their career not making word salads are being very much sidelined and being told, no, you can't do that because of X, Y, Z. So I think fundamentally, I'd like to bring back the culture of yes and the culture of excitement around creative. You know, the industry was really built on the principle of yes and, the foundational rule of improvisation that then encouraged building upon ideas versus shutting them down. And I think we've become a bit of an industry of, yeah, but you can't do that, so no. Or, well, why don't we just put this in there as well? You know, it doesn't matter. Yeah.
So I think we could never get away with that. That's, we hear that all the time, that we always, oh, I like it, but we'd never get away with it.
Yeah, you know, like legal concerns, platform limitations, budget constraints, or like risk aversion, or the data says this. And it's like so many amazing adverts, the data probably wouldn't have said yes. And yet they went out and they were absolutely groundbreaking and really moved the needle for the client. So I think we've got to this place where we've like replaced courage with caution. And instead of being encouraged and supported to knock it out of the park, they're more restricted to dribbling the ball past 17 different opinions and having to take them all on board. And there's just not really that support. And without the culture of yes, when creatives are sharing work, we're just never seen. And this is why I think so much advertising is so bland now and so mediocre. It's because without that culture of yes, we'll never see those campaigns that could have moved culture forward. And I think it also goes back a bit to what we were talking about before, that culture of no at the moment is also holding us back from this diverse space that we would do so much better in. You know, rather than talking about the need for diversity, how about we just make it happen with more of a culture of yes, and we actually do bring that to the fore. It's like we think that we're this kind of future-facing, culture-making industry, but we're not. So I think we really need to bring back that excitement around what we do.
Yeah, I love that. And I think there's something really interesting in this idea of the culture of yes. And there's something, and I don't know who I'm paraphrasing here or who I'm quoting, but there's a technique that I sometimes use. Instead of saying no, we ask what would need to be true in order for us to do that. So if we were to say yes to that idea, what would need to be true? And then we would go through the things that would need to be true in order for us to be able to say yes to it. And if those things we're not able to get to, right, okay, but what would need to be true in order for that to happen? And work your way through it. So try and think about, if we like that idea in theory, what would need to happen? What would need to be true in order for us to do that? And I think that's hopefully a bit of a positive thing that people can do to flip it on its head.
Yeah, I think it's a lazy response as well. I think that if we all actually remember that feeling of when you do an amazing piece of work and it goes out there and gets talked about and changes culture and maybe even wins an award, that is worth the effort to make things happen. Yeah. And I feel as though we're in a little bit of a time of people are very comfortable to not have to push it too hard.
Yeah.
They use it as a bit of a lazy, nah, we won't do that. Let's just do this. It's safer and easier.
Yeah, and that's the biggest irony, isn't it? That idea of it being safer. We hosted an event recently and I tried wrapping the event up at the end with an ending that turned out to be really shambolic. But I was trying to tell a story about my dad in the 70s and make a convoluted analogy about bravery. But my point was, and the point I wanted to end this event on, is all of the things we've talked about throughout this day, all of the different channels that we've talked about, all of the different tactics, the use of, from the use of audio to the use of broadcast to the use of social media, PR, etc., none of this matters if you are, so if you're not the market leader, nothing that we've discussed today will make a major difference to your brand unless you are prepared to be braver than the market leader or braver than the larger competition who have the ability to outspend you. You need to be prepared to be braver. And that means you need to be prepared to accept some form of risk in what you're doing, because the biggest risk is wasting your money and being ignored, right?
Yeah. And I think this is the random thing that creatives always see. We're always a bit like, what are you talking about? What is the risk? Because this makes perfect sense. You want to get attention. You want to stand out. You want to have a message that makes people notice you and love you, ideally. And you're saying that's a risk. Whereas we're like, hang on, the risk is absolutely that you're just going to do a really turgid ad and no one's going to care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If that media investment is your own money, what would you see as being a risk? I'm pretty sure you'd see a forgettable ad as being a risk, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm convinced on both of those things. I'm convinced that word salads should be banished forever. And I'm absolutely convinced that the culture of yes should be brought out of Marketing Room 101 and brought back to the industry. Now, before you go on your merry way, my brother is a super fan of this show. He is, to my knowledge, still the only super fan, although you've listened to nearly every episode, so you might be the other. He sends me a question every week and he's not in our industry. So he wanted to ask you, what's the one thing about Britain you wish LA had? And what's the one thing about LA that you wish Britain had?
Okay, so I think in terms of what I wish LA had that Britain has is, I do, if I'm completely honest, miss the incredible historic architecture. So just recently when I was back in London and on the cab journey from the airport into the middle of London and going past all these amazing historical, beautiful architectural buildings, that did have a little pang in my heart of, oh, this is so lovely to look at. LA kind of gets away with it because of the palm trees and the sunshine, and that's so pretty to look at. So yeah. I can kind of live with it. But on the flip side, what I wish the UK had that LA has would be, I think, a real positive mental outlook. And I'm not saying that Britain loves to tear successful people down, but they definitely love the underdog until the underdog gets successful and then suddenly they don't like them anymore. Whereas here in LA, I feel like people want you to succeed. So the people, they have got that yes and mentality. It's like, oh, you want to do this? Well, I know someone that can maybe help you over here. Or there's no judging in a way of like, oh, they've got a bit too big for their boots. I think there is that desire to achieve and do great things and not feel that in some way that makes you really, really unlikable. So yeah, I love that positivity. There's definitely a positivity in the air. And maybe that does come from having so much sunshine. I think it probably does have an impact on that.
Brilliant. I love that answer. I think the architecture, absolutely. It's hard to walk or travel through London, isn't it, without being mind-blown, even as someone who lives in the UK. I find it brilliant. But I think, yeah, that last answer about, I think that's something we can all learn from. That could be another Marketing Room 101 thing to bring out, I guess. It's quite refreshing for someone to come on and say, you know what, why don't we all just have each other's backs and let's all just try and do really good work for good clients and do a good job and support people who are trying to do well. And I think that's lovely. Yeah. But I think the whole tone of this I've really enjoyed. So thank you for coming. Before you go, I just want to ask, how do people find out more about Jellyfish? How do people listen to the podcast? How do people get involved in Good Girls Eat Dinner? All that sort of stuff.
Okay, so Good Girls Eat Dinner has a website, simply goodgirlseatdinner.com. The podcast, you can find it either through the website or on Spotify. I think it's also on Apple. It's just called Good Girls Eat Dinner, the podcast. You can find me on LinkedIn and Jellyfish as well. And yeah, if anyone wants to ask me any questions, do reach out.
Amazing. Thank you very much, Jo.
Thank you. It's been really fun.
So that was my conversation in Marketing Room 101 with Jo Wallace. If you enjoyed it as much as I did, I'd love it if you could just take 30 seconds to leave a quick review wherever you listen to your podcasts, because doing so tells Spotify and Apple, etc., to introduce more people to the show. And if you'd like to get in touch with me or keep up to date with new episodes coming out, just find me on LinkedIn under my name, Ben Norman. I'm the one with no hair. And if you'd like to know more about Principles, where I do my day job, just head to principlesagency.co.uk.